Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
So welcome at ZEUS, welcome at the podcast that brings you insights from research on Eastern Europe. I'm Stephanie Orfall, I'm part of the communications team here at ZEUS, and I'm going to be your host today. The church situation in Ukraine is complicated. The majority of Christians are Orthodox, but there is not just one church. There's the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, but there's also the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. The Ukrainian Orthodox Church is considered a part of the Russian Orthodox Church, which was before expressed in the name of Moscow Patriarchate. On 27th May, 2 years ago, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church has called itself independent from the Moscow Patriarchate. Of course, the reason for this was the start of the full-scale invasion and the staunch support of the Patriarch Kirill for the war. And the Russian Orthodox Church is an ideological pillar of the Russian regime for years. But the debate in Ukraine around this church is far from over, and many question the sincerity of the split. Today we speak with two researchers who are specialists on the topic of orthodoxy. Andriy Fert is at the moment a visiting researcher at ZEUS with the UNET program. He's based in Kyiv. And Andriy has completed his PhD on the Orthodox Church in the late Soviet Union. He has been a research fellow at the EVM in Vienna and has been part of other research projects. And he joined ZEUS in 2023. And here he's studying the impact of the Russian war against Ukraine on the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So that's exactly the topic we want to talk about now. And he's going to tell us what he has observed in his research so far. Regina Elsner is a theologian, and she is now a professor at the Faculty of Catholic Theology of the University of Münster. And she was a researcher at ZEUS before and a dear colleague until only a year ago in 2023. Luckily, she continues to be a research affiliate at ZEUS. And she's not the first time here on this podcast. In fact, she was already in the very first episode in 2019. And thanks for coming back. So as it is apparent from these short biographies that you both know so much more about this topic than could possibly fit in this one episode. So what we will do is to put links to some easily accessible resources in the show notes of this podcast. And I also know that for many of our listeners, and that includes myself, this topic is not so familiar and at times can be quite intimidating, but that's what we are here for. And we have our two experts to help us. So let's get to it. At first, I think it would be a good idea to start understanding a little bit better what the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is. So Regina, can you help us get started to go a little bit back in history maybe and tell us about what the place of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is, what its connection to the Russian Orthodox Church is? Not all the way through history, because that would be a little bit too much, but in the time of after the independence of Ukraine.
Yes. First, again, thank you for having me. Indeed, this topic is very broad and we could talk about this for hours, I guess. So to make it short, the key word you have already put on the table, it's independence. So the story of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church somehow starts or gets really important with the independence of Ukraine, if we talk about this time frame. So, of course, you could talk about the 1,000-year history of Orthodoxy in the region, starting also from Kyiv with the baptism of Volodymyr. But if we talk about our current times, the story starts in the 90s. And in the 90s, the independence of Ukraine and of all other former Soviet republics brought huge changes for the religious communities, because before it was an atheistic regime and now it started to be religious freedom. And Ukraine from the very beginning had a very liberal law on religious freedom. And this means that the Orthodoxy, the overwhelmingly Orthodox population, came back, was newly initiated in this time. And Orthodoxy for all the territory of the former Soviet Union was somehow bound to the Moscow Patriarchate. So the Moscow Patriarchate was the center, the administrative center of the churches, of the Orthodox churches in this region. And it is a common story for Orthodoxy that when a state gets independent, the church, the majority church, if it is Orthodoxy, tries to also get church independence. And there were huge movements within Ukrainian Orthodoxy to get this church independence also. But the Moscow Patriarchate refused it, and it gave a huge autonomy to this church. So the Ukrainian Orthodox Church was a church with huge autonomy. It was almost not impacted by Russian church administration and so on. And it developed quite a distinct Ukrainian identity in this time. Nevertheless, there was a part of Ukrainian Orthodoxy which was not happy with this decision about huge autonomy and wanted to have full autonomy, the so-called autocephaly. They didn't get it, so they just founded a second structure, the so-called Kiev Patriarchate then, Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Ukrainian Patriarchate. And so we have already in the 90s several Orthodox church structures in this country. The only difference, there are no differences in church teaching, in dogmatics, in faith, there is no difference. The only difference is, to put it shortly, is state loyalty, is national or cultural loyalty. The Ukrainian Orthodox Church always put it themselves as Ukrainian, but having transnational links to Russia, to the Moscow Patriarchate. And the Kiev Patriarchate Church always put it an emphasis on national identity, on being Ukrainian, being a Ukrainian church. And the difference for church matters was that the Kiev Patriarchate never was canonical, as we call it as theologians. So it has no, it had no church recognition as being a true church for world Orthodoxy, for other Orthodox churches and so on. So it was a Ukrainian church without any links to other churches in the world. It just existed. It was not small. It was not marginal, but it existed. So we have a situation where we have two Orthodox churches being very concurrent with each other, contestation, having contestation about public issues, about political issues, about church issues. But we also have religious freedom in the 90s where all churches could find their place, could have their talks with politicians, with society and so on. And there was no privileged church or religious community in Ukraine since the state is independent. And this is very important also for our further talks.
Yeah, thank you. So what about the place in Ukrainian society? You just mentioned that now there have been different churches and some of them appear to have a stronger connection to the state, to seem more patriotic in a way. And what does this mean for the place of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in society, Andriy?
Well, we should begin it by answering a little bit more about what the church role in Ukrainian society at all. I mean, in more general terms. So yes, it's like a common wisdom that Ukrainians are religious, but they are religious in a very distinct sense, in a very distinct way. Well, when people are confronted by this, you know, sociologist in the street and being asked if they are religious, if they believe in God, and if they identify themselves with, for example, Orthodox Church, well, 70 or 80% says, yes, we are Orthodox and we belong to the church and all this sort of stuff. But when it comes to actual church attendance, you know, praying, going to the church, doing some church stuff, etc., they're like, well, 10% or even less than 10% of the Ukrainian population actually go to the churches and actually take part in the church daily life. You know, even less than that knows something or a spell of something, glimpse of something about the church doctrine, about the rituals, etc. And, well, like few of them can, you know, for example, recite the most common prayers. So when we talk about the role of the church in the Ukrainian society, we should acknowledge this fact that there is a lot of people who says they are Orthodox, that they belong to the church, but they do not actually go to the church and take part in the church daily life. So religion to these people are important, and well, they value religion, they value the Orthodox Church, and they, you know, say they belong to this church, not because they're religious, not because they believe in God, but because they consider Orthodox Church some part of their national identity or their cultural identity. So like Regina said, there's been a millennia-long history of the Orthodox Church presence in this region. So inevitably, the church, well, you know, it left traces in the national culture, in the national history. So their religion is everywhere. If you open the history textbooks for children at school, it's like a lot of churches, pictures of churches there, different religious figures from different centuries present there. But that doesn't mean that children, by reading these books, become religious or want to go to the church. But religion is present in their life in this way. So there are a lot of people who do not go to the church, but to whom the church is very important. And when it comes to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, that in a way linked to the Moscow Patriarchate, it's only natural that this group of people for whom religion is part of their cultural and national identity, that they cannot stand, you know, the very fact that there is a church in Ukraine that, you know, holds several sacral spaces, but this church belongs, it's subordinated to the Moscow, to the Russia, to some other country. So it's part of our national identity in simple words, but it's somehow subordinated to Russia. So it doesn't mean that these people go to churches and, you know, take active part in religious life. It's oversimplification to say that all people who, you know, criticize the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate or whatever we call it, that they are all not religious or they don't go to the churches. But mostly the people who are criticizing church, they mostly are not religious. They don't go to the churches. You know, they affiliate themselves with religion, you know, as they consider religion as part of their national or cultural identity. That is why it's so important for them. So when we talk about this place of the Ukrainian Church of the Moscow Patriarchate now has in the Ukrainian society, we should keep in mind this fact that Ukrainians, by and large, you know, perceive the Orthodox Church as part of their national identity, their cultural heritage. And that is why they cannot stand, the majority of society cannot stand, that there is a church that is subordinated to some other nation, some other religious center outside of Ukraine. That is why Ukrainian Orthodox Church has a very, the place it occupies in the public space or in national affiliations, etc. It's dropping, it's shrinking, it's getting smaller and smaller by the day. Mm-hmm. Because, well, people cannot, you know, accept the fact that there's a church subordinated to some other nation, etc.
Maybe to add a little bit on this, and because the last thing you said is very important, Ukraine is also a very secular society now. It is a very modern society and a very secular society. So the place of churches, of religion at all in such a society is a huge question, as it is for our societies in the West. And you can understand from what Andriy now said that the connection of Orthodoxy with national identity or with cultural identity is really an important part of all of this story, because for people, it's not relevant what the church teaches about moral behavior. Yeah, you have a little bit an impact on, of course, the questions of homosexuality or reproductive rights and so on. They have a huge part in the public discussion there, but they don't have it because people care about what the church says about their personal life, but they care about because the church is part of the so-called cultural identity, national identity, where something is perceived as not being part of our culture. So homosexuality is not part of our culture. And then you can put in here the church and say that, so the church doesn't say this, and so this is part of our culture, but it's not because of religious grounds. And this makes the question so manipulative. Yeah, you can instrumentalize this question for national and cultural ideas. And we see this very much all the time when Ukraine publicly struggles about place in the world. So being part of Europe or being part of Russia. And we have seen a lot of these struggles during the last three decades. So we have had the Orange Revolution, we have had the Revolution of Dignity, the so-called Euromaidan. And always at this point, the churches gained some bigger public relevance, because they public figures tried to use the churches, to put the churches in this discussion as being standing for the one or the other idea, standing for more European idea, more Ukrainian idea, or standing for a more Russian or more integrative idea with the Eastern part. So this is important to understand this discussion, because it's a secular society as our society, in fact.
Mm. So this becomes extremely marked then with 2014, I guess, when the war starts. And then I think there has been a very important development in 2019 when there was the so-called autocephaly granted to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which has been an important development here. And I think we should have a brief look at it. Regina, could you explain what happened there?
Yes, the situation indeed developed since 2014, because there were two important events. The one is, of course, the Maidan, which with its pro-European commitment. And the churches played a very big role in this. They were very present. All the churches were present. The Maidan were on the side of the protesters and took solidarity with the protesters and with the pro-democratic movement. But we also had the second important event. The head of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church died, the then Metropolitan Volodymyr, who was a very important person for the Ukrainian identity of this church. And the successor now, Metropolitan Onufri, which we have until now, was not so outspoken in the public space. He was more closed and don't wanted to interfere with public debates. So since 2014, we have seen growing debate about where the Ukrainian Orthodox Church belongs to, where Ukrainian Orthodoxy belongs to. And the Kiev Patriarchate was very forceful in pointing to, we need Ukrainian Orthodoxy, we need to sever any ties with Russia. And then we have had, of course, the important election campaign of Petro Poroshenko, the then president, who made this question of religious identity of Ukraine part of his election campaign. And so he went to, they asked again Moscow for independence, for church independence. Moscow naturally said no. And then they went to another huge Orthodox church structure, the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, so which is based in Istanbul. Patriarch Bartholomew, who is perceived as somehow the primate of honor in the Orthodox world community, and they ask him to grant Ukrainian Orthodoxy this independence, this autocephaly. And the Ecumenical Patriarchate was very hesitant before, but in 2018, because of the Maidan, because of the war going on since 2014, was now more decisive and granted autocephaly independence, church independence to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, as it was called. There was a council where all Orthodox churches of Ukraine were invited to make some kind of unification of Orthodoxy in Ukraine, and then to find a new church, one structure, one united church structure for the whole country. The problem is that this council failed because the Ukrainian Orthodox Church did not attend. They don't wanted to take part in all of this and don't wanted to be to get the autocephaly. There are difficult canonical questions in here. There are difficult procedural questions in here, which are too complicated to explain them now. But the result is that we have, from 2019 on, independent, accepted, acknowledged from other churches, acknowledged Orthodox Church of Ukraine. And we have the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which was still affiliated with the Moscow Patriarchate and don't want it to unite. So in fact, this autocephaly is, of course, a good thing because it granted a lot of Orthodox people in Ukraine an independent and accepted canonical church where they could go to if they don't want it to be in connection with the Moscow Patriarchate. But we have still no unification. We still have two churches which are concurrent. They don't want to be together. They don't accept each other. They tell their people that they don't have to go in the other church because the one church is perceived as Russian. The other church is perceived as non-canonical, as not being righteously in this place in Ukraine. So they are blaming a lot each other. There's a lot of mistrust between these churches. And one of the big problems was then the question of church transfer. So could parishes switch their jurisdiction? Could parishes decide how they could decide to change the church jurisdiction, to go to one or the other church, to belong to one, to the one or the other church, and so on? So there are a lot of conflicts about this raising after 2019. And the aim, the original aim to solve this problem, to have unified church in Ukraine, did not happen, did not succeed, and more problems started, I would say.
Mm. And if I may add at this point, I mean, what happened in 2019 when this new church was established, it is impossible, you know, to properly assess this development without, you know, looking a little bit backward at the very were a very important problem that Ukrainian Orthodox Church that belonged to the Moscow Patriarchate had and still has, and that's the problem with communications. So Regina mentioned that this new head of the URC, Ukrainian Orthodox Church, he was very, well, he's a monk, and he, well, in a way, a recluse, so to speak, in public. So he doesn't usually comment a lot. He don't speak with the media. He don't give interviews, whatever. And sometimes he said something, well, probably in a proper context, it might have said good, it might have said okay. But when it was taken out of the context, and given the fact that he's not given interviews explaining what he's talking about, the context is absent. Well, everyone says, oh, this is a pro-Russian statement he made this way, oh, that way. So once upon a time in 2015, that was the first year of his reign in the church, this Metropolitan Onufri, there was this, as you probably remember, that Russia began the war in Donbas in 2014. And in 2015, that war was in full swing. It was very active and Ukraine was retreating and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Metropolitan Onufri, well, took advantage of a church celebrations of St. Volodymyr's Day. So it's a very important holiday for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. And he took advantage of this holiday to say that there is a civil war going on in Ukraine, and that he forgot to mention that the civil war was, well, reinforced by Russia. He mentioned only civil war, and you know, he appealed to the Middle Ages to compare the situation that is going on, that was going on in 2015, to what was going on in 10th century, saying that in 10th century different princes that, you know, reigned in this territory, they also quarreled with each other, but then they, you know, converted to God and they decided to find a peaceful solution and to live in harmony and in peace, etc., etc., and said that we should do the same thing today. We should, you know, listen to the people of Donetsk, to the people of Luhansk, and, you know, stop this bloody war because it's destroying Ukrainian nation. And he forgot to mention Russia. I don't think that he deliberately did that, that he was really pro-Russian guy who, you know, forgot to mention that Russia started this, that Russia annexed Crimea before that. But he was so, well, he was not very good at communications, and he didn't, you know, once the public outrage started after this statement, he didn't do anything, you know, to quash down this, to cope with this, to attend to this, to say, no, you didn't understand me right, I meant something different. He didn't do that simply. And, you know, there are a lot of statements like this. And so it helps the society to begin to perceive this church as being really pro-Russian, as spreading Russian narratives, as, you know, helping Putin's agenda, etc., playing to the hand of Russia, etc. So that is why Poroshenko in 2019, 2018 and early 19 was so successful in convincing the Ukrainian society that we need to gain independent church, that this church that is subordinated to Russia is not real church. They spread Russian narratives, they spread Russian propaganda. So we should do something about it. And, well, the church, because of the lack of proper communication, well, it helped Poroshenko do this effectively and, you know, to have to create this another church because they were so bad at communications and still are. They still are.
This also goes a little bit back to the question about the place in society. So this church has really no experience in communicating with society. Yeah. The media plays a really huge role in this, because if you're not able to communicate in this media space, the people won't forget, and the media won't forget, and the internet won't forget those short stories of miscommunication which happened, and they will bring this up and up. And if you don't have a strong counter narrative in the public sphere, you don't have a chance to win this. Yeah.
Well, this probably links to the main topic, actually. We wanted to talk about what happened after the full-scale invasion, but it's important to understand. So the situation is that this church now that you just described finds itself confronted with the fact that Russia starts its aggression against the whole of Ukraine. Also, the believers of the church find themselves in a church whose head still, right, is actively or constantly justifying this war that is led against their own country. So that's the situation in 2022. So how did the church react to that? What did they do? Andriy, can you get us
started? Yeah. Well, it took several, once again, the church had communication problems. So the war, this full-fledged invasion, started in February. And so despite that, it took 3 months, I guess, for the church to decide what to do, to convene the council where all representatives of the church dioceses or church regions were present, and to say that we want to sever ties with Russia, that we are now independent. So the church decided after 3 months to convene a council and proclaim independence, as they call it, from the Russian church. So this is what they did in 2022, 2 years ago. The tricky question here at this point is that you mentioned several times this hard to pronounce word called autocephaly. What church did in 2022, they didn't proclaim autocephaly, they proclaimed independence. And that is very important. And that is why there's so many criticism of what this church is doing and what is its relation with Russia, and do they have any relation with Russia after that proclamation. Because, well, in Orthodox administrative practice, well, in canons, as Regina called them, it is important, if church want to be independent, it should proclaim autocephaly. This is the word that denotes some specific religious canonical practice. It should be, you know, it should be initiated. But the church decided not to proclaim autocephaly. They proclaimed independence. So they used the secular wording, independence, instead of autocephaly. And so they didn't really launch this, a real process the church should launch in order to get other churches' recognition of its autocephaly. So technically what they had to do in order to, you know, break ties with Russia, they should say, we're autocephalous church at the moment, and send letters to other churches around the world saying, we are autocephalous, please recognize us. But they didn't do that. They simply said, we are independent, and live with it without explanation. Once again, there was this communication problem. So they said, we are independent. And when they've been faced by questions such, does it mean that you're autocephalous? That you mean that you're autocephalous church, independent church, truly independent church? They says, well, yes, 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 we started this process and no details followed. So they proclaimed independence in 2022, 2 years ago, in an attempt to, you know, stop this rather hostile attitudes, not just from Ukrainian society, but from many priests within the church, because they, like you said, Stephanie, they found themselves in the one church with the guy who literally justifies the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So they didn't want to share this church with that guy. I mean, the Patriarch Kirill, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, they didn't want to have him as their superior leader. Mm-hmm. And that is why they pressed their bishops, they pressed the Metropolitan Onufri to proclaim at least something, to proclaim independence. But like I said, the problem was with the wording. They proclaimed independence, not autocephaly. And the people who know something about the canons, people who know something about religious legislation, so to speak, they started asking questions what that means. And the church failed to explain, failed to take this next step in order to, you know, proclaim a real independence, autocephaly in earnest. So this is one thing that the church did. But yeah, there's a lot of things the church did not, and many priests inside of the church, many parishioners, many active believers who attend the church on a regular basis, I mean, the church of this Ukrainian Orthodox Church, they start asking questions, they keep asking questions up until now, like, there are territories of Ukraine that have been occupied by Russia, and there are bishops of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in these territories, and they support Russian aggression. They said, oh, yes, great. Russia came to liberate us, and the church leadership says nothing to condemn them. They do nothing to condemn them. They said they did not do this communication once again. And that really irritates a lot of people inside the church, because they say people in our community come to us and says, you belong to the Moscow Church, and this parishioner, this local priest explaining, no, we're not Moscow Church, we separated from, we proclaimed independence. And then this local people saying, but you have a bishop in Donetsk who support Russian aggression, and your head of the church, Metropolitan Onufri, says nothing to condemn them. They do not take any disciplinary measures against this bishop. They did not excommunicate him. They did not, you know, forbid him to serve church services, etc. So the church fails to actively condemn collaborationism, and that is a very dangerous thing. And I encountered that. It provoked a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of resentment among the members of the same church. So the priests and parishioners, they are, well, to say it bluntly, they're pissed off by that their bishop do not support them, they do not help them to prove that they're truly Ukrainian people, that they support Ukraine, not Russia. So the church proclaimed independence, but that independence was like lukewarm. Well, if we take this orthodoxy procedure that should have been observed in this particular instance, it wasn't observed. So it's not autocephaly, it's simply independence, and no one knows what that means. And there's a problem with collaborationism of a lot of top clerics, and church did nothing and does nothing to effectively condemn them and to prove that we're supporting Ukraine, etc. So this is what the church did after the war started. Probably, Regina, you have something else to add to this.
Yes, I would like to add a little bit on this, because what we see from what Andriy now described, we see that we have a problem in categories. So again, this is about the secular and the church divide, because people want to see independence from Moscow. And what does it mean for a church to be independent? We have no clear idea about this. And if you look at this seriously, what the Ukrainian Orthodox Church did is quite logical in this idea of a secular society and secular state, of course, of politics, asking for independence. They have the right to ask for independence in this political and secular meaning for a church to have no ties with the aggressor. And then the question is how you will prove this, that there are no ties. And then you have on the other side the theological understanding of church canonicity and of church autocephaly, of community, of church community. And what can it mean for a church to sever community with another church? So the Orthodox churches understand themselves as a huge family of churches which have communion with each other, although they have autocephaly or church independence. And it seems to me that for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, it is very difficult to prove on the secular level, with secular measures, how they stopped being in communion, in church communion, with the Moscow Patriarchate. These are really difficult categories to be kept separate, and it's not possible in this situation of war to keep them separate. And the responsibility for this complicated situation is in Russia. So it's the Moscow Patriarchate and the Moscow Patriarch, Kirill, who is using the church as a political tool. And then you have no possibility to separate those both spheres anymore, because it's Russia who says, yes, of course, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church belongs to us. The Moscow Patriarchate does not accept this claim of independence of the church. It continues to tell the world, up until the Security Council of the United Nations, the Russian Orthodox Church goes there and says, we have to defend our believers in Ukraine. This church is part of us. And of course, Ukrainian society goes nuts about this, because then they have the proof for, of course, this church is a Russian church. See, the Moscow Patriarchate is presenting this church at the level of the United Nations. How can this be? So this is just a little bit to describe the complicated situation this church is in. The big question, which also the Ukrainian state wants to solve with law drafts and so on, is to force the church to make inner church decisions. But a question of a secular state and religious freedom is, can a state with laws intervene in inner church decisions? Is this possible or not? And I would say it's not, or it's highly critical, of course.
Thank you. We have the question of how the believers and the people react to this as well. So there was a significant drop, I think, in surveys from people who said they were affiliated with the Ukrainian Orthodox Church after the full-scale invasion. Can you tell us the reasons for this? And what does it mean for the future of the church? Is it getting smaller? Is it losing people? Also, maybe in regard to what you said before, that a lot of people see as a part of their cultural identity and are not active churchgoers. And is this, what about churchgoers? Is there also a change? Is there a change there?
Well, I guess the latest survey that was, I guess, in 2023, found out that there were only 4% of Ukrainian population who said they belong to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, as it was formulated in the questionnaire.
Which is not the name of the church, just to put this again. This is not the name of the church, the Moscow Patriarchate.
Yeah, and this is a really significant drop in affiliation, because before the full-fledged invasion, I guess there was like 15 or even 20% of population identifying with this church. But the reason for that, in my understanding, is not as that the people are dissatisfied with the church performance, with the church communication, etc. Probably the reason is more trivial than that. And this trivial reason is related to the fact that there's war going on in Ukraine and there's martial law and there is a lot of restrictions existing in Ukrainian daily life that people who doing research not really acknowledge in their studies. So imagine yourself in a country at war and at war with Russia, being confronted on the street by an unknown person with a questionnaire asking you, do you belong to the church of the Russian Patriarchate or the Moscow Patriarchate or whatever? What would you answer to that sort of question? It's only natural that people in the street don't usually, you know, are very, well, do not trust strangers and saying, yes, I belong to the Church of Moscow Patriarchate, because it's natural that people, well, like, don't feel quite sure what the intention of this person could be. Probably this is a state security agent asking them, and if the answer is wrong, they'll be taken for further interrogation, so to speak. I really, you know, just blacking the pastures at this point. But, you know, in a country at war, when there is a constant feeling of danger, and when there is this overwhelming, ever-present, omniscient feeling that Russian is our enemy, and when you are being confronted on the street and being asked if you belong to the church of the Moscow Patriarchate, it's only natural that you respond you do not, even if you do belong to this church. So I think that it's a very significant thing that for reasons I don't understand, that many sociologists in Ukraine do not acknowledge in their reporting on surveying people's religious identity, because this is really a very influential fact. And I have several parishioners whom I interviewed for my study anonymously, obviously, and it took like a lot of efforts to persuade them to give me those interviews. And they mentioned this particular situation, that if they'd be confronted in the streets being asked by sociologists if they belong to the Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, they wouldn't acknowledge that fact. They wouldn't say they belong to the Moscow Patriarchate, because it's simply not, well, quite safe to say that. So this is one thing. This explains probably the drop of affiliation, such dramatic drop of affiliation. Because when we look, because Stephanie, you mentioned that it is those people who perceive religion mostly as their cultural or national heritage, national part of their national identity, don't actively attend the church on a daily basis. So in terms of church attendance, it is very hard to say if there has been any drop in attending of the temples, of the parishes, of the monasteries that belong to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So those parishes that I interviewed, that I studied, they all, well, when you come to these parishes to study them on Sundays, so the typical day when they held this church services, is always full of people. It used to be full of people before the war, and it's still used full of people. So, and this is one thing. So I don't observe this drop of church attendance in Ukrainian Orthodox Church. But yes, obviously, I don't have any representative sample to prove that. It's simply impossible to do that given the situation with the war and the restrictions it imposes. And the second thing, which, well, in a way testifies that there's no significant drop in real church attendees and in the people who really attend church on a regular basis, is that we don't see a real avalanche of parishes switching from the Church of Moscow Patriarchate, in quotation marks, to the more Ukrainian church. As far as I remember, the most bold figures that there are available at this point saying that since 2022, I guess roughly 1,000 of parishes switched affiliation from the Church of Moscow Patriarchate to the Church of Ukrainian Patriarchate, so to speak. But the question is, how do we monitor, how do we corroborate and verify these results? Because mostly when you look closely at those lists of parishes, you see there's no real evidences that they switched affiliation. So sometimes the situation is quite sadly funny. So imagine, well, for example, a village, and there is a church in this village. It's only one. And there's like 20 people who go to this church, who attend this church on a regular basis. So they go every Sunday, they pay some church fees, some donations, they do some job in the church, etc. And there are like 100 other residents in this village who do not go to the church, but they show up at Easter, for example, or at Christmas, because it's natural, because it's religious holidays and everyone observes this holiday. So they typically do not attend church on a regular basis. The church for them is their part of their culture. The church for them is part of their national identity. The church is part of their festivities, but it's not part of their daily life. So it's only part of daily lives of those 20 persons who go to this church on a daily basis. But then the war begins. And everyone around says, oh, this is the wrong church. This church is subordinated to the Moscow Patriarchate. This church, you know, justifies Russian invasion and we should do something about it. And those people who do not go to this church on a regular basis, they gather together and says, let's vote. Let's switch affiliation because it's our church and we don't want to have our Pascha, so this traditional bread being blessed during the Easter services. We don't want to have our Pascha being blessed by a church of Moscow Patriarchate. So let's switch affiliation. And those 100 people in this village, obviously I'm very simplifying things, but those 100 people from the village, you know, held the meeting and says, we want this church to switch affiliation. And the state representative in this local community, in this village, says, okay, and, you know, the document's been signed and the church switched affiliation. But those 20 people and their priest, who are really members of this church, who are really, you know, are religious practitioners, they did not switch affiliation. But at this point, they find themselves without a temple to hold the religious services and without official recognition by the state as being a religious organization. So, and there are plenty of examples like that. It's hard to measure and to calculate what share, what part of those 1,000 parishes that switched their affiliation since 2022, what part of them are real switches. So are real parishioners gathered with their priests and decided to go to another church? And what part of them are those, the cases that, like what I mentioned at this point? And there's also third, well, very important factor is that there is a local authorities, and the local authorities, well, they don't want to have Moscow Church in their domain, so to speak. And sometimes they want to prove they're very effective in solving some dangerous issues and, you know, in a way to show their superiors that they're very effective in their job. So they come to the religious community that belong to the Moscow Patriarchate and says, you have 48 hours to leave the church. Either you switch to the truly Ukrainian church, or we just close your church down. This is the end of story. And there are several examples that I know personally, and I now arrange an interviews with those people who encountered this situation when they're being, well, faced with the local authorities saying you have 48 hours and you have to switch. And they switched, because they had no other opportunity, no other way out of this situation, because otherwise they would have lost their building, their temple for the religious services. So there are a lot of factors that we have to consider at this point. And yeah.
Thank you. Thanks also for making this so clear. The examples you mentioned are all very telling of the status that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church now has, how it is seen from in the rest of Ukrainian society. I think even after the independence from the Moscow Patriarchate, there has been a lot of criticism of the church and of its clergy. You already mentioned that there have been cases of collaboration, that church has been instrumentalized in Russian propaganda, and some of the clergy have taken part in spreading Russian narratives. So let's talk about the reaction of the Ukrainian state, because there have been not just criticism, but also concrete political steps that are considered. So the Ukrainian parliament considers to ban religious organization under Russian influence, which would probably directly also target the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. Regina, can you give us an update on that? What is behind this?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I would like to first also draw a short attention to what you just said, that we have not only criticism about this church in the society or in the state, but we also have strong criticism within this church. And it's important to understand that most of the parishes and most of the priests have a distinct Ukrainian identity and are really not understanding what is going on at all with them. So why is the pressure? Because they live also in western part of Ukraine or in the central parts of Ukraine, and they have never had any connection emotional or not with Moscow, and they don't understand what their leadership is doing. So we have also huge conflict within this church, and it's very difficult to grasp it as one. As in surveys, it is very difficult to really catch what is going on with this church. And it's also from the political side, of course, very difficult to give this, to have an impact or to perceive this church as one church and to understand or to say it in simple words about what is with this church going on. Is it Moscow affiliated or not? It's very complicated and very difficult within the church. And so what is going on with this law or with the law drafts? There have been different attempts to make laws which make the life of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church as difficult as possible. There have been prohibitions before. There was an attempt to force the church to change its name, for example, already in 2019. And now we have a long discussed law draft, which would it make easy to prohibit the church as a whole on the territory of Ukraine. This law has been very much discussed for quite a long time. It is very problematic from the point of view of religious freedom because it is an interference in religious matters. It is, in fact, what I talked about earlier, the question if a state with a law can interfere in religious self-identification, if this is possible or not. And I think it's not from the point of view of European or universal human rights and religious freedom laws we have. But there's also a problem of proceeding. So the church in Ukraine is, all churches are registered as separate organizations, religious organizations. So every parish is registered as an individual religious organization. So that means that every law which tries to prohibit a religious community will have to go after every single parish. And the law now has passed the first reading. There have been a lot of amendments, a lot of clarifications and discussions about single aspects of this law. We now have just published a week ago, I think, or some days ago, the third draft to be presented for the second reading with new amendments. And the law has gotten worse. So it was already a quite bad law draft. It's getting worse because it operates with a lot of understandings and concepts which you cannot grasp with law. So you have the huge understanding of affiliation, a church affiliated with a religious community outside of Ukraine, which is providing aggression, military aggression. Every religious community should be prohibited, which has such contacts or affiliations with a church, with a religious community in Russia. So what is meant is Russia, of course. But what does affiliation mean? Does it mean control? Does it mean direct impact? Does it mean contacts? Does it mean finances or something like that? So this is a problem, which will be a problem if the law will be implemented, that it can be used quite arbitrary, in fact, from the lawmaker. And that it will make a lot of trouble on the local administrative level to prove, to get evidence, if there is some evidence of contacts, of control, of affiliation, whatever it means. We also see in this law that there are provisions which try to prove the contact or the affiliation of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church with the Russian Church by looking at the Russian documents. So the Ukrainian Orthodox Church has no impact on the Russian documents, what is written in the statutes of the Russian Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate. But the law says that if in this documents of the Russian Orthodox Church is written that the Ukrainian Orthodox Church belongs to the Russian Orthodox Church, this would be a reason, this could be the only reason to start process of prohibiting this religious community. So you see just from this example that this is really a problematic thing going on. But it is, of course, a reaction to the unclear situation. So I don't want to say that this is all just lawless stuff which is going on. But of course, the Ukrainian state has an interest in defending national security. The problem is that you have to balance here religious freedom with national security. And this is really a difficult thing because, in fact, religious freedom is part of national security. You cannot have the one without the other. And this makes it so complicated. And what is the bigger problem for me in all this draft law discussions is that the public discussion is very heated. You have a lot of hate speech against this church without having any evidence or having enough evidence to blame the whole church of being part of the Moscow Patriarchate. You have individuals and you can, of course, persecute individuals for law violations. You have all the laws you need for this. But what is going on now is a public discourse which is directly and in general attacking this church as a whole. And this is a problem for the people who are defending Ukraine at the same time.
Andrei, in your research, you are talking to exactly those people who are affected by this right now. So you made interviews and observation and a lot of Ukrainian Orthodox parishes. What have the people told you? What is their view on the matter, or what is their view on their position in the society? How do they deal with that?
Because Regina mentioned it in her response that priests have distinct Ukrainian identity. Many members of the church have distinct Ukrainian identity and they don't understand what is going on, why they're being accused of being pro-Russian. I would slightly disagree with that. I disagree with that by saying that they, not naive, they understand why it's going on the way it's going on and what's happening. So a lot of priests, a lot of parishioners that I talked to and interviewed for my research, they understand why it's going on to them. So I ask everyone to think about why their church being called Russian, why they're being so, well, hated by a lot of people in Ukrainian society. And there are plenty of plethora of different responses why that's happening. And once again, the most widespread response is, once again, bad communications. So there are like a lot of priests, a lot of church members whom I interviewed who says, we're trying to do our best in our parish. We collect the aid for the front line. We help the internally displaced people. We help local authorities to provide housing, to collect funds, to collect food, to collect whatever. And yes, we say in every sermon possible, we publish it in our parish website, on our Facebook, that we condemn Patriarch Kirill, that we are no longer part of the Russian church. And then the next day, our bishop came out with a sermon saying that there is no war between Russia and Ukraine, that this is a civil war, and there's no real war going on, and that Ukraine should be liberated from this fascists and etc., etc., etc. And so the bishop spoils everything. And then
this is in fact what I meant, Andre. I meant they don't understand what is going on with their leadership. Why are they doing this stuff? So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of resentment against the superiors, against the bishops, against the church leaders, among the parishioners, among the parish priests. So there was one priest whom I interviewed who was so angry that he said that he is ready to take a hammer and go and hit his bishop with that hammer, because that bishop is just so insanely stupid and he spoiled so many things in his diocese and he complicated and he put this parish in jeopardy with his stupid statements. So there are a lot of people inside of the church who are very unhappy with their leadership, with their leaders and where they lead them and the way they communicate. So when I asked them why Ukrainian society is so hostile to them, to the Ukrainian church, one of the most widespread responses is that a lack of good communications and, you know, unclear policy of the bishops and the church leaders. They don't quite clearly communicate what they're doing with the church and why they're doing it this way and not another one. And also, I just don't want us to, you know, to represent the church as simply victim of the situation. Yes, there's a lot of discrimination in the law that's been considered by the Ukrainian parliament. And if adopted, yes, that law is that will present a real challenges and real problems for the human rights and for religious freedom in Ukraine. That's true. And yet, a lot of priests and a lot of parishioners, once again, with whom I spoke, and I mentioned this slightly in my spotlight, so go and read it if you listen to this podcast. There's a lot of as they call, as the parishioners and priests call, there are a lot of pro-Russia people inside of the church. And so, virtually everyone, like everyone with whom I spoke, says at some point in our conversation that there are some people with pro-Russian views, pro-Russian attitudes inside of the church. So there could be bishops, There could be other parishioners. There could be priests from the neighboring parish that is known for his love of Russia, or a nearby monastery where the monks love Russia very much, etc. So they all mention that they have Russian people in the show, and that those people blow any sort of reform, any sort of changes, any sort of good communications that the people who are pro-reform, pro this separating from Russia, pro-independent, pro-autocephalous, that they face any problems, any obstacles imposed by those people who didn't want any changes in church to take place. So when I asked them who are those pro-Russian people, once again, there's a plethora of responses, and they were not very connected to one another. So there's this recent statement that was, I guess, several weeks ago. The head of this Orthodox Church of Ukraine, so this competing church, another one that was established in 2019, he was asked to comment about this 4% of people, of Ukrainians, who say that they belong to the church of, the, once again, quotation mark, Moscow Patriarchate. And this head of this competing church says, yes, those people are all pro-Russia, they all have this Russian conviction, they don't support Russian invasion, etc. But when you actually speak with people who really belong to this church, yes, there are people who support Russia. We should say that they are there. And they're very reluctant to discuss this with you, obviously. They use hints, they use, you know, evasions, they use metaphors to describe their attitudes, but there are people with pro-Russian attitudes. For example, I interviewed one parishioner who was very reluctant to speak about what she said, politics. But she suggested me to read several books. And when I opened those books, it was quite clear what sort of beliefs and what sort of attitudes she had. Because those books about the Ukrainian was invented, not by Lenin, by Austrian in First World War. And that Russia liberates the godless West from the godlessness, all this sort of stuff. So you can imagine that. So there are people in the church with pro-Russian views. They're reluctant to discuss it, but there are there. And it exasperates a lot of parishioners, a lot of priests with whom I talk. Returning to this head of the competing church, so they said all those 4% of people who attend the church of Moscow Patriarchate, they're all pro-Russian, they have pro-Russian views, etc. But inside of the church, there are like really a lot of people, a lot of different opinions, a lot of different understandings, why we go to this church, why we belong to this church. And to say that the majority of them support Russia or pro-Russian in any sort, it's like a real exaggeration. But yet again, that it's quite difficult to actually to calculate the actual numbers, because it's impossible to do that. As you can imagine, the church that is being called Russian by Ukrainian society, there's been about, is about to be banned by the Ukrainian state. Members of this parishes, members of this monasteries, members of the clergy are not very happy and not very open to discussions and not very open to interviews. So it's quite hard to find this relevant sample to discuss something with. So yes, there are pro-Russian people, but once again, it's quite difficult to interview a representative sample of priests and parishioners to find out how many of them are in that church. And getting back how they perceive this law and the fact that they've been called pro-Russian, I like one response that one priest gave me. He said, yeah, I disagree that our church being called Russian or pro-Russia, because we're not pro-Russian, we have Ukrainian flag in our church. Yes, we don't pray for Russian military, we pray for Ukrainian military, etc. But then again, he said, I understand why they think that we're pro-Russian. Because we have bishops who are unable to communicate clearly that we have nothing to do with Russia, or to condemn those clerics who were caught collaborating with Russian occupiers, etc. And he also added that the church has been for quite a long time part of the Russian church, and it was always proud of that. And he says that now bishops and now church leaders are very slow in, you know, dismantling this proud, that they are very slow at dismantling this image that's been, well, present since Ukrainian gained independence in 1991. So he is unhappy once again. I'm returning to that same point. He is unhappy with communications. So it's like the most popular response, that communications are so bad, and that really helps Ukrainian society hate church more, and Ukrainian state to instrumentalize this hatred in order to promote this restrictive legislation. And yes, I wanted to add it when Regina was talking about the legislation. So this law that is being considered by the parliament and be likely adopted in near future is very complicated. I mean, it could not, well, the very next day the law is adopted and entered into force, and it would not automatically ban the church or all this 10 or somewhat thousand of religious communities that belong to Ukrainian Orthodox Church across the country. This law requires investigation. And in order to investigate each of 10,000 religious communities, you need resources. You need people who would, you know, collect on a daily basis proofs that you could use at the court in order to ban this religious organization. State does not have that scope of resources to effectively enforce this law, which means that probably will not be enforced in the earnest. I mean, there would not be 10,000 investigations going on after the law is adopted. But I believe that this would give the Ukrainian state additional leverage. So it means that you have a parish, for example, in some city, and the local authorities wanted the parish to help them with something. For example, please collect some additional money for this or that or that. And they come to them and says, please do this. Or if you fail to, we can start investigation and find out that you have some links to Russia or whatever, and we will disband your religious community. So that would give effectively additional leverage to Ukrainian state. And I have no idea how they're going to use that leverage, but it's very bad they would have it because it's not, well, it's contrary to the rule of law and human rights.
So thank you. I think with this analysis and with this outlook, we're going to finish this as we are nearing the full hour. Thank you for your insights in your research and for shedding some light on the issue, explaining it to our listeners, and for joining us today. And as mentioned in between, do check the show notes. We will link to some of the text where you can find further reading on each topics. Thank you, Regina, and thank you, Andriy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.